Welcome to That Optimism Man podcast, where we explore the transformative power of optimism through extraordinary voices shaping a brighter future. I'm Victor Perton, That Optimism Man, and today I'm absolutely delighted to introduce Dr. Karen Johnson, a true beacon of optimism, resilience, and hope. Karen's journey is one of courage and purpose. She married young and, together with her late husband, raised a family while earning 6 degrees between them, building a life grounded in education, volunteerism, and leadership. Today, she serves as a faculty member at the University of Phoenix College of Doctoral Studies and consults across higher education, mentoring students, and shaping minds in education management and leadership. Her white paper, The Resilience Factor, American Workforce's Adaption to Ongoing Challenges, reveals a powerful and interesting truth. Over two-thirds of American workers are optimistic about their careers, driven by resilience and the belief that challenges are opportunities in disguise. What sets Karen apart is her deeply human wisdom, born not just from research but from life itself. As she so beautifully told me, optimism is not about denying hardships, it's about believing the light will return even in darkness, and it's up to us to work to find that light. Karen, thank you for joining us on That Optimism Man podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to talk about optimism. It's one of my favorite topics today.
And you are an expert. So everyone who visits the Center for Optimism gets asked this question, Karen. What makes you optimistic? Is it your life experience, your mindset, your faith, relationships, or the fantastic research that you do?
Well, Victor, I think for me, optimism is really deeply rooted in a combination of all of those things, our life experiences, our mindset, our faith, our relationships. You know, I've lived through some profound loss. I lost a grandson about 16 years ago when he was only 5 years old. And more recently, my husband of 57 years on this date last year. But through grief, I've also experienced and witnessed resilience. Optimism is not about denying hardships. It's not about denying that things will be bad. It's not denying that sometimes things will be horrible. But it's about choosing to believe that no matter how dark it gets, it will be light again. But it also is incumbent on us as individuals to work to find that light. So I think it is somewhat it's not just life experiences, but it is the mindset that I'm not going to live like this. I think to some degree, I'm optimistic because life is a lot better than if you're pessimistic. When you're pessimistic, you really restrict yourself and your life experiences. I think you had a guest not too long ago on one of your podcasts that talked about pessimism affecting your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
And I really love that thought, because if you don't look to the right and look to the left and look up and look down, you're so restricted in what you see as your possibilities, and you miss so many things in life. And if you see only what's right here in your face right now, today, this hour, this minute, things might not look that great. But if you look around you, there are so many opportunities for growth, for change, for helping others, for teaching others. The opportunities are endless if you look for them. I think we become what we look for.
I think David Cooper Ryder, in his writings on appreciative inquiry, talks about that, you know, that what a society asks questions about is the direction that society heads. And I love that notion of foresight. And you know, the OECD, I think, you know, talks about optimism as being a key to life satisfaction. And it's people being able to both enjoy what they have today, in a sense, smell the roses and look forward to tomorrow.
Exactly. And I think that looking forward to tomorrow is such a huge piece of optimism. And it also then makes us resilient so that we can continue to look forward.
Yes, that notion of persisting, because by persisting,
Things will get better. So you shared a little bit of your life journey. So what's the life journey that took you to this passion for optimism, resilience, and helping to build that optimism, resilience in the American and the global workforce?
Well, I think my life journey is different enough that it helped me see lots of other opportunities. I married young. I got married between semesters during my senior year in high school because my soon-to-be husband was moving away to another state and I was going to go with him. I was 17 and a half, but I was pretty sure that's what I wanted to do, and I did. So I always tell the story. The kids like to call it our love story, but I tell them it's a story about a plot where many, many things had could have gone wrong. But for us, they didn't. They did not. You know, we married young, we had children, and while we were having children, we both went on to college. We earned 6 degrees between the two of us and built two excellent careers. We traveled a lot. We did a lot of amazing things. We made a few mistakes along the way. There were some things we could have done better. That's life. Life is not perfect. So that's been a challenge for me to accept over the years that it is sometimes those imperfect things in our lives that make us see possibilities because, you know, if there's nothing bad, how do you know what good is? You know, so there's that. But we've done a lot of volunteer work through the Lions Clubs International organization. Both of us have worked as volunteers over the years and moved way up in the organization. So we've traveled quite a bit doing volunteer work, like in New Orleans after Katrina, and in Mexico, helping to build orphanages and water supplies for small communities, and seeing how other people live and what great opportunities we have, which seem so far beyond what others have had, really makes me grateful. And so, you know, gratitude is a big part of my life. I try to practice gratitude on a daily basis, and that helps me stay focused. There's always something good to find, and it's like I mentioned earlier, you find what you're looking for. So if you're looking for things to be grateful for, you'll find them. If you're looking for things to be disappointed in, you'll find that too. So I really think it's a lot of it's focus, and we were able to take the things that were occurring in our lives and use them to help other people. And not let any of the negative things or grief after a loss consume us. We learn to learn from it and teach others. And, you know, I like to say life just keeps lifing. So we have to use our optimism to keep growing. And I see a lot of that in our students. I teach doctoral students in the College of Doctoral Studies. And many of our students come from backgrounds that are not unsimilar to mine. They are often first-time college students, you know, first-generation college students. Many of them are single parents, and most of them have some career already in place, but they're optimistic enough to know that they can do and be better, and they're resilient enough to take any setback and use it as a setup and keep moving forward. And I love working with the students through the process of writing their proposal, getting that approved by the IRB, conducting the study, writing the dissertation, defending it orally, and finally becoming a new doctor that often people in their families would have thought could never happen. But if you're resilient enough, it can. And so I see that on a regular basis, and that carries over into the workforce that they know that once they've been able to achieve that, then there's probably no real limits or not many limits on what they can obtain, what they can aspire to and become in the workforce. They've learned how to take a little setback if something's not approved along the way, and you know, regroup and go at it in a different direction, and become successful in their jobs and in their careers as well. So a lot of what we do changes not just the person from an educational standpoint, but it changes the lifestyle for entire families.
And that's taken you to writing a fascinating report, which is called The Resilience Factor: American Workforces' Adaption to Ongoing Challenges. And I think one of your findings is quite staggering in these bleak days and all of the bad news, that two-thirds of the workers declare optimism about their career futures.
I find that amazing as well. Every year for the last several years, the university has commissioned a career optimism study, and the report of that is made available to faculty, and we can choose to address some portion of that report in a white paper. And that's how you and I kind of met up with each other. Is I think you saw my white paper published somewhere, and then you ran parts of it on your website, which I really, really appreciate. But what I found is I took the mental health figures out of those reports every year for the last few years and wrote a white paper about that because this was like right after COVID and people were looking for more mental health assistance from their employers, from the workplace. And there was a bit of a disconnect because in the early reports we saw that employers felt like they offered a lot more resources for employees in this category than what employees took advantage of or claimed to know were available. So that was became very interesting to me. And so this year I wanted to try to look at it from a different angle. So I took the lens of resilience and said, okay, but we're just looking at how resilient the workers are. Does that make a difference in why they're optimistic? And of course it does. I mean, absolutely. The report showed that the resilient employees aren't just those who have the ability to withstand adversity, because there's certainly been a lot of that in the workforce the last few years, but it's those who believe that challenges can become opportunities that really can fuel resilience within themselves and those around them and begin to make a difference in their own workplaces or move to another workplace where they see that there's a greater opportunity there. And I think that's why we see 66, percent of the people, two-thirds of the people reporting that no matter what's going on my job today, I feel optimistic that it's going to get better in the future.
I think the Beatles had a song, "Things are getting better every day."
Right.
My daughter and I drove from Toronto to New York in July. It was very hot. What was interesting was, we were going through those rust bucket cities, the Syracuse and the like, those old manufacturing capitals of America that, have not recovered, although Syracuse now I think is going to be a world center of silicon chip making. So I'm fascinated. The American workforce does seem to be very flexible and prepared to move, more so than I think. I live in Australia and people are relatively flexible, but there's something about the American workforce about that moving to pursue opportunity. And even university-wise, your students tend to move to other cities, whereas in Australia, our kids tend to stay in their home city. So, what is it about Americans that make them that much more flexible in the workforce?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, we've always kind of been thought of as the land of opportunity. I live in Illinois, and I think that's the slogan on our license plates for the state, the land of opportunity. But we've always been a country of people who move from east to west. We moved west and added states and grew, as the United States of America. Because when things didn't work out in one place, they just went somewhere else and they overcame, for the most part, whatever obstacles they might have found there. So I think it's just kind of in our, maybe it's in our genes by now because we've done it for a couple hundred years. But I do see what you're talking about, that it's not uncommon for someone to go to a university in another state and then maybe stay in that state for their career, or go to a third place, for their career. It's not uncommon for, people to meet in colleges, and one of them's from the East Coast and one's from the West Coast, and they end up together somewhere else. And that there's not a lot of, I don't want to say that there's still strong family communities. I don't mean that. The family relationships are still strong, but I don't think there's as much geographic strength as there is. We're part of this great United States of America, wherever we are.
Yeah, I read a piece the other day. Someone was bemoaning America, the state of America, and I said, for me, when you think back to send me your huddled masses and that whole notion of America as the center, global center of optimism. And I lived in San Francisco and Silicon Valley for several years. And, it's ground zero for optimism. And Kara and I once had to give a speech to a very big business audience in Phoenix. And, I'm in my 60s now, so I don't often get butterflies in my stomach when I'm about to speak. But sort of 600 American business people in Phoenix, I'm thinking, what can I say to them about optimism? Well, as the chairman of the organization said to me afterwards, Victor, you ne needn't have worried. And a lady got up after my speech and she said, I was born in Nigeria in a time of war, and my name means the future is better. I'm with you, Victor. And the crowd roared. And then this quite small blonde lady got up and she said, took the microphone from the lady and said, and my name is Hope, and I'm with you, Victor. And so for me, when I think about, America at its best and America's influence on the world from, 1945, maybe even after the First World War onwards, it's been that export of optimism and, the attracting the optimists. So do you think, I'm taking it beyond where I was originally going to take you, but you inspire me. Do you think the secret sauce of America is optimism?
Well, I think in a number of areas, it certainly is. My late husband was from Texas, and for about 20 years, we lived in West Texas in the heart of oil company country, in the heart of the oil country. And certainly the petroleum industry thrives on optimism. If you don't believe that there's oil underground, you're not going to spend the money to drill. And if you don't drill, there's no oil. So there's this constant effort to keep everybody optimistic, because that's what drives that whole industry. So I think that's part of it. I mean, I think it's also, like you said, in the Silicon Valley. And so it's probably in other places as well that I'm just not familiar with. But yes, I do think that's true.
Australia, my work in America was made easy because the American stereotype of Australians is that we're relentless optimists and the sort of person you want to have a beer with after work. And speaking of Texas, I was once at a barbecue that Governor Perry hosted for us, and he declared Texas was the lost tribe of Australia. So perhaps there's that really, that lifeblood of optimism. I think in your report, as you generously said, I was fascinated by your report. And, early in our research, we said that optimism drives resilience. And in that sense, inspired a little bit by Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and his essay on tragic optimism, or Jane Burns in Australia, very similar, when the going gets tough. You want the optimists. And so what connection do you see between optimism and resilience? Because I'm sometimes driven nuts by resilience being build another dike or build another earthwork or spend another $1 billion on aeroplanes. But I think it's what's in people's hearts.
Well, I agree. I think it's our ability to recover and adapt. So if we don't have that within us, then things don't get better, things don't move forward. I think resilience is the what, where optimism is the how, the mindset. But also think resilience helps us to, well, maybe together, resilience and optimism drive us to take steps to make things better, because things aren't just going to get better just because we want them to, or because we want to believe they do. But even like in this the report that we've been talking about within the research, it showed that organizations have to foster an optimistic culture that's more that creates more adaptable and engaged employees and teams. But the individuals have to find their own personal development strategies. And I think that's the resilience when they take additional training. There's, skills building makes a difference. They build stronger networks and relationships. So those are the kind of things that make a difference. I think that's what comes out of resilience.
Yeah, and in fact, last week I delivered what was the largest masterclass ever in the Australian Public Service, and it
Wow.
was on optimistic leadership. And what was lovely was the organisers said the response afterwards, people sending feedback, was the strongest ever, and that the clear message was people want more on how to be optimistic. So, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, OECD, as most people know it, they've done a global study which says that optimism is the key trait underpinning life satisfaction. And their concern is that we're not teaching that to young people. And they would advocate that we actually explicitly teach optimism in schools and colleges. Do you reckon it's a good suggestion and one that's viable?
I do. I think it should be embedded in how we teach other things as well. Optimism should be embedded in how we teach problem solving, for example. It should be embedded in how we model and encourage a growth mindset. We don't just want to present challenges to students without teaching them how to look at the challenges and see them as possibilities, as opportunities to do bigger and better things and to keep moving forward. So I think there absolutely is a role for teaching optimism in schools. If we have students perhaps reflect on past experiences, particularly with our adult students, and see how they've overcome other things, how they've found that light after the darkest days, then they can see how, well, it's happened before, so I can do it again. So I
I
think
love
all
the
of us
two things
can.
you've said there, Karen. One is model. So I was very fortunate 4 years ago to be in an audience with the Dalai Lama, and it was during COVID, so it was done via Zoom, and there were 20 of us. And it wasn't me who asked the question, it was another person who said, "How do we foster optimism in the young?" And he said, "There is nothing more important than fostering optimism in the young." He said, "But as you know, you can't tell a teenager to be optimistic. You have to model optimism." And I was talking to a mother yesterday, she was talking about her teenagers, and she gets them at the table to do the three best things in the day. And I said, "How about you try and go first? So instead of getting the kids to do it, why don't you say, 'I had an absolutely exceptional day, and I did this, this, and this.'" Did you do it? And I think, reversing a little bit, parents are very good these days at getting the kids to talk about the good things, but not necessarily modeling that themselves. So I love that wisdom in what you say, Karen, and you obviously do it, in your supervision of doctoral students, and your own exemplar or example of writing these white papers.
I think it's really important for students of any age to be able to see what success looks like. So don't just tell me that I need to go do something. show me what that has looked like when someone else did it. So that's why modeling becomes so important. And it's important that they see people who look like them, people who sound like them, people who live like them, to know that they can in fact follow those same trails and those same, follow those footsteps and have the same success as those people have. I had a student a couple of years ago who she really struggled, and a lot of her struggles were because of her own self-image. She was a single mom, had been out of work for a while. She was had some kind of job, but not a career that she was, wanted to have for herself and her children. And she said that she had been told by many people around her that trying to get her doctorate wasn't a realistic goal for her because that wasn't a realistic expectation for people, air quotes, like her, whatever that meant, And so we worked really closely with her. I worked closely with her, and every time she did something well, we celebrated it. So the next time something came along, whether it was just writing a good paper in a class or finishing a class or making a major step in creating her dissertation proposal, whatever it was that she was doing, we looked at that. We stopped and talked about how much progress this is from where we were a month ago or 3 months ago. And what did you do to get to this point? And when she could reflect on that, then she could see what she could do to get to the next step. There's this beautiful picture that we sometimes see on a meme on social media. It shows this tall flight of stairs, and it says you don't have to see where the top step is. Just take the first step, one step at a time. And if you have the courage to take the first step, then you can take the second and the third and the 15th and the 20th, whatever it takes to get to where you want to be. And I think that's really true with, the resilience and using the resilience to build optimism.
Yeah, joy, optimism, and resilience. I was very fortunate a couple of years ago, an organization called the Art and Science of Joy approached me and they wanted optimism to be the first superpower of their year of joy. And at the end of the year, I wrote a reflective essay and I said, the optimistic tend to be more joyful and the joyful tend to be more optimistic. And I grow roses out of the front of my garden and they're called Tequila Sunrise, and there's Fearless, which is a technicolor orange. And I really make a point these days of just stopping and smelling that rose and being infected by the color, and sometimes just putting it up on my X account or my Facebook account, and it tends to bring people such joy. So, and Karen, you strike me as a joyful person. So I'd like that idea of encouraging the student to be joyful at each step. And I teach a subject in the Australian Public Service called Developing Great Policy. And you can develop a wonderful policy. However, the government might be buying $350 billion worth of submarines. And that bit of budget item might knock out yours. And exactly as you say, I encourage them, look, if your boss says your draft is good, celebrate. If the secretary of the department's prepared to send it to the cabinet process, celebrate it. And if it gets knocked out, it gets knocked out, and that's life. So, Karen, I can feel that real sense that you're encouraging them to experience joy in those little successes.
And I think they have to celebrate in whatever way is comfortable for them. They don't need to look and see how somebody else celebrates. Maybe it's spending time with someone. Maybe it's, treating yourself to something that you might not have otherwise. Maybe it's just taking time to reflect on how good this really feels in the moment. However we choose to celebrate, I think that just really increases our joy and our belief that, life is good. Life is good, and it can be good without every day being wonderful. But if we can see that as the overall bigger picture, and celebrate all those good things along the way, then life It's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You make it better because you believe it will be better. And because you've believed, you make it better. And because you make it better, you continue to believe it will continue to get better.
Oh
So,
gosh, that's almost a thought. If only we could bottle that formula. That's so beautiful. When I think of your work in New Orleans, post the hurricane, and it seems to me that the people of New Orleans, for instance, that mixture of American and French culture and their love of music, seems to me that they're a joyful people, so that even after the disaster, they were more likely to get better quicker. And my daughter and I traveled to Samoa a couple of years ago to a town that had experienced a 15-meter tsunami, and it had killed many people. And yet, a very faith-based community, and we met people who'd married, widowers who'd married widows and the like, and built new lives. And that society, even though they could still feel the grief for a dead wife or a dead child, nevertheless, it was a better society after going through the disaster than it was when it started.
They seem stronger and more focused and able to spend time on celebrating every little experience that they've had that's positive. When we were when we were in New Orleans, it was early 2005, so it was almost a couple years after Katrina and Rita, and we worked with a local Lions Club there that had gotten a grant from Lions Clubs International and from the Burlington Coat Factory. And we took thousands of winter coats to kids at the schools and handed them out to kids who, 2 years after the devastation, still didn't have a warm, decent, comfortable winter coat to wear to school. And to see those kids line up to get a coat, any coat, just, line the hallways, it was just amazing. And my husband was always a bit of a rebel rouser. He wasn't a great rule follower when it wasn't his liking. So he got in a bit of trouble, and it was a great time. They told us that the local people at the school had lined up all the coats on these long tables in a gymnasium, and they had girls' coats on one side and boys' coats on the other, and they were lined up by size. And each kid came up to one of the Lions members who was there, and they had a little card that said, boy size 12 or girl size 8. And the person who was handing out the coats was supposed to reach over and get the first boy size 12 coat and give to that person. So we noticed that one part of the line is moving along really fast and the other part not so much. And so I look up, and I'm not surprised that it's the line where my husband's handing out the coats. And I hear somebody who knew him well from the back of the room yell, "Johnson, you're holding up the line. Just give them a coat." So I walked up to see what he was doing, and he was letting those little boys pick out what color coat they want and letting them try them on. We would have still been there if he'd
I can
had his
imagine your husband making sure they had the orange ones and the yellow ones and the
He did.
colorful ones.
If you wanted a blue coat, he was going to find you a blue coat. If you wanted an orange coat, he was going to find you an orange coat and as close to your size as he could find. And so there were two or three other people who went up and started helping him. And there's this amazing picture of him. He was a big, tall Texan, 6'2", and he was leaning over, putting a jacket on a little boy. And I shared this story and this picture with the Lions of Illinois magazine, and they ran that picture on the cover with that. I can't remember now whose quote it is. It says, "A man never stands as tall as when he leans to help a child," and I thought that was so indicative of everything that he wanted to do there. And except, in his case, he was going to do it his way, and it all worked out, but it was funny to see how heartwarming that was. He was like one of the little kids having such a great time. And I think that's one of the things that made us resilient, because we took in so many great feelings from helping other people that it kind of didn't matter what we needed in the moment. We got our pitcher filled back up by helping someone else. And
I
I
think
think those are the
there's
things that
two
do make us
things.
joyful and optimistic.
I have a friend, James Strock, who used to live in Phoenix, and he runs the Serve to Lead group. And that notion of service leadership, and you and your husband obviously exemplified that. I think the other thing you exemplify for me in being optimistic and resilient is your storytelling. So in your research, have you discovered, the secrets of, that storytelling, and I think you talked about nostalgia, for instance, to look back on the good things. So nostalgia and storytelling, I think they're very powerful underpinnings of both resilience and optimism. What do you reckon?
I think that's absolutely true. And in our research classes that where we work with our students on how to choose a research design, I often depending upon the student's topic, of course, but when it applies, I often recommend that students do either a narrative inquiry, research design, or phenomenological design, because they get to hear the stories and analyze the stories and find common stories or common phenomenon. And I think that there's a really important skill in being able to look through all that data and find what is the bigger story. And if they can tell that at the end of the research, then I know that they've really understood what they've done, they've gained from it, and they're providing us something new in the literature. They're filling some gap that's there now. I think storytelling is extremely important.
Yeah, my friend John Hagel the other day wrote an essay about the white space between us and artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence has the sum of all written knowledge on it. However, we're the ones that can create something new, something different. Look, over the last 10 years, my friend Robert Masters and I have been looking at originally what we thought was the problem of leadership. And then, after almost 3 years of research, we worked out the problem was not the problem of leadership. The problem was the fog of pessimism. And late last year, we looked at all of our research, 10 years of interviews and thousands of people. We asked what makes them optimistic. And we've come up with what we call the optimism principle. The answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. The answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. Does that resonate with you in your life as a mother, a grandmother, a wife, a supervisor, all those experiences you've had and your ability to lead?
Absolutely. I mean, it is. I mean, from every question, like, how do we adapt to change? By being optimistic that change can occur, that a change is there for a good reason, that change can be good. It doesn't, it's not negative always. It can be a good thing. It answers the question, it's the answer to how do we improve education? We look at what's working and we're optimistic that we can find things that might work better. Where if we ask how do we keep going after loss? We get whatever help we need, which is, something we haven't always done as a society, but I think it's more common now. We use whatever trick is in our bag of tricks to help us make things better. I just feel like it's like a whole, like you said, the whole realm of major questions. The answer can be optimism. It can be being the person who optimistically believes, strongly believes that there can be light and it can be better light after a dark period. I agree with that premise exactly 100%.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Pollyanna. When I started out the Centre for Optimism, I was this typical big Aussie bloke, and I'd say, "Oh, let's do realistic optimism and not this Pollyannaism." And I had this leading lady engineer in Australia lean across the table at me, and she said, "What's wrong with being a Pollyanna? I only do things that will change the world for the better." And I've subsequently written an essay, because if you really read the book Pollyanna and the film versions, it's not a silver lining in every dark cloud. She's in the middle of a dark cloud and she's looking for that ray of light, the light at the end of the tunnel. So I often think, people talking about Pollyannaism or you're a Pollyanna as a pejorative is often blokes putting women down for their positivity. So I'm very naughty, Karen. My gender pronouns, and of course, you gender pronouns are being pushed in Australia. So my gender pronouns are Pollyanna optimist.
I love that. I actually saw that after your name in, I don't know, it was on LinkedIn or in your email. I love that because I wanted to say at one point when I was thinking about what I might talk to you about and about my own thoughts on optimism, I wanted to say that I do tend to look for silver lining in most clouds, but I don't necessarily think that's the same as looking at life through rose-colored glasses, because that doesn't acknowledge that everything's not rosy, and it's not. But I also was going to say, don't mistake me for a Pollyanna. And then I read your email where you had that as one of your pronouns. And I thought, oh, I probably won't say that to Victor, but here I have anyway, right?
Wear Pollyanna as a badge of honor. Anyone out there listening who thinks they're a Pollyanna, wear it as a badge
Right?
of honor.
Right? I
Can I
love
take you
that.
back into the world of work? One of my friends at the University of Sydney Business School published a study last year called The Optimism Effect. And they'd looked at 25 years of OECD data, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development data. And they said that optimism is the key driver of capital formation, productivity, and innovation in both countries and corporations. And so, have you in your work, looking at workers and looking at successful corporations, I think the research is very strong. Do you reckon educational institutions and the like are ready to pick up that research and run with it?
I suppose that varies institution by institution, but I think maybe higher education especially is looking more and more like students are customers who are looking for a product that helps them build a better life. And so if we can help create an environment where they can see again, that's that modeling piece where they can see what success looks like, if they can get the steps that take them there, if they can reflect on past experiences, if they can build relationships. Build relationships is really important in optimism and resilience both. If they can build relationships among the student body, among the faculty, if they can work as cohorts, then I think yes. I think education can very well become a center of optimism, if you will. It can be a site and a principle that helps everybody see a brighter future and work toward that brighter future.
Yeah. Look, we've really hit the hour mark. I could talk to you for hours and hours, Karen, so I'm going to have to try and book you in again. Just coming back to young people, and you work predominantly with younger people. The old British Commonwealth, there's 53 countries in it, from England to Australia to Canada, through to small countries like Samoa and the like. And they had their biannual meeting last year. And they finally, for the first time, could see this problem of declining optimism. And they pledged to restore hope and optimism in our common future. So if you were the Prime Minister of Canada or the Prime Minister of England or the Prime Minister of Australia or the Prime Minister of Samoa, what would you tell, or what would you tell them on restoring hope and optimism in our common future amongst young people?
I think it's so necessary if we're going to restore optimism among young people, is not to just be a cheerleader, not to just say, you know, you got this, go do it. I think it's also about equipping them with skills. It's equipping them with beliefs that their efforts will make a difference. I think we underestimate what young people want to accomplish in their lives. It always annoys me when people talk about this generation and they, you know, they're doing this or they're doing that or they're going to miss this. They didn't have the hardship we had. Blah, blah, blah. Hasn't every generation since Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel said that? And so, you know, if I were in some really horrible world crises situation right now, I'd want to be with the 20-year-olds because they're the ones who know how to get us out of most anything. It's not those of us who think we're the old sage on the stage, you know? So I think that we equip them by modeling, by giving them resources, by recognizing and celebrating their successes, we make it possible for them to become and remain optimistic. We have to create a culture where that can happen. We can't force anybody to do anything, but we can create a culture that what we are looking for thrives within that culture.
Yeah, and we are the culture, aren't we? Later on today, I'm going to be talking to some business leaders, and often they say, what should I do? And I say, start by just smiling and saying hello to everyone you pass in the corridor on the street.
Right.
And they sort of look at me as if that's too simple. And I said, when did you last do it? When did you last do it? So given your deep expertise in optimism and its application, what tips and tricks would you give to our listeners to be more optimistic in their own lives and to be more infectiously optimistic themselves?
Give to whom?
To our listeners.
Oh, okay. I think recognizing who we are as individuals is a really good starting place. Maybe we have to learn how to be grateful, because I think practicing gratitude is a huge, huge piece of optimism. But maybe we don't really know how to be grateful. So learning what that means to us as individuals. What am I grateful for today? And it might be something really big, and it might be that I remembered to buy cream for my coffee. You know, it's whatever makes us joyful today. I think we have to find from within ourselves what brings us joy, and then where do we want that joy to take us? Because I think sometimes we stop too soon. We stop with, okay, anything is possible, but there's always that but, because we don't know where we want that to take us. So I think a lot of it is that knowing ourselves, that self-reflection, that nostalgia, as you mentioned, for things that have worked well in the past, and how do we make things, you know, use those same skills and characteristics that we have to move forward.
Karen, this has been stunning. I'm just so enjoyed the conversation. So I'm going to have to come and visit you at some point so we can just spend hours and not just online.
Right, right.
Is there a question that I didn't ask you that you, a reflection, a thought, some wisdom you want to share with our listeners before we sign off today?
Just that life can be good. It won't necessarily come to us. We have to find it. We live what we search for. I think we become what we talk about. We become what we read. We become the people that we spend time with. So I think we have to be mindful of what we read, what we watch on TV, what movies we watch, what we do, what we read when we're doom scrolling on Facebook. All of we have to be mindful of how all of those things affect our ability to be resilient and how they affect us as being optimistic or pessimistic. I think we are in charge of our own lives. If we want our lives to be better, there's lots and lots of opportunities for us to drive the bus to make it so.
Karen Johnson, when I read your reports and your research and the like, it was inspiring to listen to you today telling those stories and sharing that wisdom. You've got a fan for life, in me. So,
Thank you, and I certainly enjoy what you're doing as well.
how can people best follow the work that you're doing in your publications?
I will make sure they're on LinkedIn. Right now, they're somewhat in the research hub at the University of Phoenix, but some of them are in my LinkedIn profile. Some are on ResearchGate. But I will, you have inspired me to finish up what I started, and they will soon all be part of my LinkedIn profile.
Exactly. And maybe Karen Johnson on Optimism could be a good book.
Maybe.
If
Maybe.
you can put me in the credits if it happens. So everyone, I'll make sure also, I mean, we've got Karen Johnson's work on our website. This podcast will go on the website and obviously on Apple and Spotify and the like. And I think there was an invitation there from Karen that you might be able to connect to her on LinkedIn or follow her on LinkedIn to follow her excellent work. Karen Johnson, thanks very much. You and I are on different time zones. For you, it's the end of the day. For me, it's the beginning
Right.
of the day. I always say the world is never going to end because it's always tomorrow in Australia.
I love it.
As we wind down from this beautiful conversation with Dr. Karen Johnson, I'm sitting here deeply inspired. Karen reminds us that optimism isn't about pretending everything's perfect. It's about choosing to believe that even when things feel heavy, there's light ahead, and that we each have a role in finding it. Karen's stories, from her love story, her grief, her resilience, her research, all carry the same message. We become what we look for. And if we look for optimism, for hope, for meaning, for opportunity, we'll find it. And that's the heartbeat of the optimism principle. The answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. So, a little invitation before you go. If this conversation lifted you up, pass it forward. Subscribe to that Optimism Man podcast. You'll find us on the Centre for Optimism website, on Apple Podcasts, and on Spotify. And perhaps today, ask someone, what makes you optimistic? Perhaps write down for yourself what makes you optimistic. You may be surprised where the conversation leads. I'm Victor Perton, that optimism man. Thank you for sharing this time with us. Stay optimistic, stay hopeful, stay bold, and have a wonderful, wonderful day.